From WBUR Boston, I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Behind much of the new building and development at research universities today is corporate money. Sometimes these new facilities or endowed chairs name their patrons, sometimes they don't. Still, there's no question that on research campuses today, the role of private industry is growing. Whether it's the result of a decrease in public funding or the chance it offers for universities to make money, the implications stretch far beyond the borders of any campus. What's at stake could be academic freedom and independent inquiry. Tonight on Point, the academic industrial complex. When business bankrolls higher education. What do you think the mission of a university should be? Do you worry about the future of independent inquiry, knowledge for the sake of knowledge, with industry playing an increasing role at research universities? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from New York is Jennifer Washburn. She is the author of University Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education, a book examining the growing ties between business and universities. She's a fellow at the New America Foundation and writes for The Atlantic Monthly, The Washington Post, The Nation, and other national media. Jennifer, welcome.
Thanks so much.
And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst and Senior Editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Gail. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello.
Jennifer, you first wrote about this, I hear, for The Atlantic Monthly back in 2000. Then the article was called The Kept University. Fair to say that things have gotten even worse since then? And if so, give us an overview.
Yes, I think we can say that things have gotten worse, partly because universities have been so silent on this issue. It's remarkable to me that industry collaborations with universities are growing. Industry is dictating the terms of their research support far more than they did in the past. Universities are becoming rapidly commercialized, but thus far, university leaders have actually been remarkably quiet about the encroachment of a commercial mindset into the heart of the university.
Do you take this as a sign that universities are losing their sense of mission to serve all of us, not just their students?
Yes, I think that what's happened is it's not that universities have malicious intentions. I think that most of the people who are promoting these commercial ties they believe that they're serving the best interests of the university. They're trying to maximize the amount of revenue that comes in to support the research, to support the education. But the problem is that they're not looking at the broader picture of what this commercial funding and this increasing commercial behavior by universities themselves is doing to the academic culture and how it's eroding the university's independence, its autonomy, really its ability to perform the kind of public functions that we require universities to perform.
Well, what is sinister about this? Universities have always had buildings named after individual donors. Why is having the Bank of America dean any worse?
I think that my point that I make in the book is really that universities are going well beyond simply naming rights. I think it is disconcerting to see academic buildings that are actually plastered with the names of a corporation. But I think that what's much more troubling is really what's going on with the research enterprise and the teaching enterprise itself. And this is where the commercial influence is really far more serious. Universities themselves now run their own venture capital firms. They run their own industrial parks. They actually operate very extensive patenting and licensing operations to commercialize their professors' research in exchange for royalty revenues. So the university itself now has a direct financial interest in its own professors' research, and that is fundamentally different from anything that we've seen in the past.
So your worry is that it's becoming more about money than about education?
Yeah, I mean, at the same time that universities are pouring money into these various commercial enterprises that I've just described, they're actually rapidly downsizing their teaching force. It's really quite extraordinary, but we're seeing that at universities across the country, they're eliminating full-time professorships and replacing them with graduates, part-time graduate students and adjuncts who are paid meager salaries, virtually no benefits, to handle all the teaching load. So undergraduate students who are paying all this money to attend these universities are actually really getting shortchanged.
Give us some specifics, some examples that you mentioned in the book. The one about the antidepressants really jumped out at me.
Sure. Shortly after it came out that the FDA announced that antidepressants like Zoloft, Paxil, and other types of these SSRI drugs were associated with an increased risk of suicidal behavior in children and teens. Shortly after the FDA made that announcement, it came to light that the university professors who had authored much of the previous published research on these drugs had very, very close ties to the drug manufacturers themselves. It also turned out that those professors were complicit, let's say, in suppressing more negative data that should have come to light from their clinical trials. So when the FDA went back and looked at the raw data from these published studies, they actually found this increased risk of suicidal behavior, something that the authors had not in fact mentioned or had certainly downplayed in their articles. So this kind of collusion between university scientists and the drug industry to suppress research that might not be favorable to the company's bottom line is very disturbing, and certainly the public has a right to access the full information and not get a kind of PR spin.
Well, and you also extend that point into information sharing, because you say that universities have turned into patent factories, and it would seem reasonable that if companies are funding research, they're going to do everything they can to keep that information secret and proprietary.
Yeah, I mean, we have to be, obviously, I want to acknowledge that universities do have a very important role to play in transferring their academic inventions to industry. But the ways that universities are doing that now is very troubling. Essentially, instead of making basic research and more platform research broadly available to other academic scientists, they're now trying to patent that early stage research and essentially profit off of it by licensing it to private companies. Let me give you an example from the University of Utah. When a professor at the University of Utah discovered a new gene that was responsible for hereditary breast cancer, the university didn't make that research broadly available. Instead, it licensed it exclusively to the professor's own startup company called Myriad Genetics. And that company then hoarded the gene and prevented other academic scientists from having access to it in their own breast cancer research. This became a huge controversy throughout the world that a university would actually be stifling access to this basic information in that way.
And Jack, I'm interested in hearing from you on this, because there is something different, I would think, between directed research and the kind of I'm curious inquiry, which has also led to some very important advances.
Oh, indeed. And Jennifer, I think, has one of some of her most interesting passages, interviews with eminent scientists who say just that, and who say that if you essentially mandate the direction that research has to go, you're sort of putting a false barrier, hurdle, in the way of, well, the serendipitous, the accidental, the inspirational. And that though it looks to be more cost-effective to have subsidized, narrowly focused research, it may in the long run not be, because sometimes just the long-pursued hunch, can without any subsidy or with only minimal subsidy, can pay off precisely because it's open-ended.
And Jennifer, you also mentioned that some of the professors who have tried to buck the trend toward agreeing with whatever findings they are supposed to come up with have run into some real problems. Some of them have been sued.
Sure. There have been actually a number of very high-profile cases that are disturbing. And again, this I think is it's cause for concern that universities haven't made more of a public issue of these kinds of breaches of academic freedom. In 2000, for instance, Dr. James Kahn, an AIDS researcher at the University of California at San Francisco, he was slapped with a $10 million lawsuit after he tried to publish new research showing that his sponsor's AIDS therapy was actually ineffective. The kind of pressure that university scientists are coming under is really quite extraordinary. And part of the problem is that universities are signing research contracts that do not make it explicitly clear that the university scientist should control his own research data and should have the right to publish. In fact, in many clinical research studies now, universities are allowing the corporate sponsor to control the raw data.
And what's really new here? I have to say I chuckled in the book when you talked about how NYU at the turn of the last century owned a macaroni factory. You know, so there have always been these public-private partnerships, it would seem.
Yeah, I mean, that NYU case is really sort of an outlier at that time in history. Universities have certainly always had collaborations with the private sector, and these are very important. It's a part of the university's mission to provide service to the private sector. But what is really distinctively new is the degree to which the universities themselves are now trying to profit off of their professors' research through the patenting and licensing, and also the degree to which they're encouraging their own professors to go into business themselves. So universities now, publish newsletters that encourage their professors to commercialize their research. The problem with that is that it really pulls them far away from their research and teaching at the university. In my book, I interview a number of university-based professors who have become entrepreneurs who admit that the conflicts of interest are extraordinary, that it's very hard to devote the time and energy that they need to their students when they're off trying to raise another $1 billion for their startup firm.
We're talking this hour about the ties increasingly binding business and academia. Have you seen this trend in your alma mater? Who are universities for these days? For students? For researchers? For private interests? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the increasing role of corporate funding on university campuses. Do you see an academic industrial complex at work on your campus or at your child's university? Is corporate cash on campuses a problem, or should there be more of it? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Jennifer Washburn is with us this hour. She's author of the new book, University, Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. And Jack Beattie, On Point News analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly, is with us as well. And Mark Udoff is joining us. He is chancellor of the University of Texas System, also a former president of the University of Minnesota, someone who has dealt with this and also written about it, thought about it deeply, I'm sure. Mark, welcome to you.
Well, thank you. Delighted to be here.
So give us the realities you face. What do you see as the mission of a university? Do you see the same sort of conflict here that Jennifer Washburn has documented?
Well, I probably see some of the same conflicts. I think you have to be extremely careful when you accept research funding to make sure you have conflict of interest safeguards in place and that the scientists are genuinely independent. I don't see it at quite the same level of salience. The vast majority of the funding, at least for the major research institutions, is still coming from the federal government, from the National Institutes of Health and the like. And those grants sometimes have some problems associated with them. I don't think it's University, Inc. yet. And I think universities have handled it well. If you look at licensing agreements and royalty streams, it's an infinitesimal part of the budget. There are many, you would be in the top 20 universities if you received $25 million a year in licensing and royalties, and frequently these budgets are over $1 billion. In the UT system, I don't know, we probably under $50 million, and we have an $8.5 billion budget. So I think, frankly, it's been a bit exaggerated, but there are conflicts. There are things you need to worry about. You don't want the people who manufacture the cereal telling you how to go about testing or whether it's preventative against some disease or another. You have to be watchful, and I think most American universities are.
Well, the University of Texas has as its industry partners Texas Instruments, General Electric, others. How have those partnerships worked for you?
Well, they've worked very well for us. I mean, one good example, I think, Cargill, when I was at Minnesota, they gave us a building and a fund, and people got up in arms and we revealed every document, and They had no control at all over the research that was being done. Didn't even have a right to see it before anybody else. Texas Instrument, there are no intellectual property arrangements. We have a technology acceleration building that's being built, and we're adding some professors. It's gone very well. GE Imaging, I suspect, will. It's really pretty nascent. That's a project in Houston with MD Anderson and other partners. But I agree, you need to be watchful because our interests are not coincident. I also don't see the... I mean, I think there probably are a few professors that are really torn because they're raising capital and they have to devote substantial hours. But I think there's still a major cultural difference at these universities. We have a hard time getting many scientists to even pursue patentable efforts in their laboratories. They want to go on to the next project and win the Nobel Prize. And maybe why you see universities trying to ask them to be more attentive to what the potential market applications in the labs is because the whole culture of many of these departments is antithetical to immediate use in the marketplace. They're just not thinking in those terms.
Jennifer Washburn, I want to bring you back in here. Do you think most universities are as attentive to these potential conflicts as they should be?
No, I mean, on that point, I would certainly disagree. I do want to acknowledge what Mark is saying about the amount of industry funding or the amount of money that universities are generating from patenting and licensing being relatively small. That is true. What's interesting, however, to me is the extent to which universities are compromising their own autonomy and their ability to perform disinterested research and preserve the public trust for a relatively small amount of money. You know, 60% of university research funding still comes from the federal government. And yet, if you look at the corporate money flowing into these institutions, an increasing amount of it is now tied to industry funding. So corporate matching grants, cost sharing, and other cooperative research arrangements essentially mean that industry now influences somewhere between 20 and 25% of university research funding overall. That's an estimate from an expert, Dennis Gray. So it's not an insignificant amount of influence that industry is exerting. In terms of whether or not universities are doing enough to manage their conflict of interest problem themselves, I think unquestionably the answer is no. There was a study in JAMA not too long ago looking at the conflict of interest policies at 100 universities. And essentially it found that there was very little uniformity amongst the universities in terms of what their policies were. Only 55% of policies required disclosure of conflicts of interest from all faculty. And I should note that that means disclosure to the university, not to the public. Most universities do not require their faculty to publicly disclose their financial ties, making it very difficult for journalists and government agencies, for instance, to know who has ties to industry and who doesn't. 19% of those university conflict of interest policies specified any limits on researchers' financial ties, such as equity, to companies that are sponsoring their research. So that's not very encouraging, I would say.
Well, I don't know. This thing is evolving rather quickly, and I think these disclosure policies are growing by the day, in part because of articles as in JAMA. But I don't start with the assumption that there's some evil menace in the corporate world that because they sponsor research, that it's necessarily bad. I mean, a lot of the research we do for companies is very much in the public interest. We leverage their support with our own support, sometimes with related activities that are funded by other sources. I do understand the problem of when you produce a product and you want to test it at a university and you have a vested interest in it being successfully tested. But I don't start with the assumption that when Texas Instrument is interested in chip development and we undertake some research at one of our laboratories to see if we can get more circuits on a chip and whether it's possible to use carbon nanotubes or whatever the research happens to be, but that is sort of prima facie an evil, and that all these safeguards are to keep this evil influence out of the university. And I would say there's another side to it. You know, we're very much in an applied era of research, or maybe a mixture of applied and curiosity-driven research. But it's no accident that NIH's budget has doubled in the last few years. You know, you're a lot better off being in cancer research than looking at issues relating to gravel. And people make those decisions in government, and it is a different source. But I think many of the corporate efforts are perfectly compatible with producing research and products that are beneficial to the American people.
Jack Beatty, I want to bring you back in. What are you making of these arguments?
Well, you could argue, I suppose, that the dollar amounts don't seem significant next to the huge endowments. But what worries me here is that all of this is happening against what I think is a kind of crisis of authority in universities. That is, the humanities and social sciences have pretty much abdicated their responsibility to pass on a body of agreed knowledge to young people. I mean, they can't agree on what it should be, and therefore core curricula are either out the window or severely attenuated. Now, that means basically the old authority of the university, which is to create critical minds, to give people a moment of kind of intellectual leverage on the world, that's out. And in comes a new kind of authority, the commerce, that says, listen, okay, these humanists and others, they can't agree on why you should go to school. We can tell you why, to get a job. And there's nothing wrong with that. And, of course, there is nothing wrong with that, except that that's not the traditional role of the university. It's not thought to be a trade school, whereas now something like a third of university students work full time. It's a job for them, and they're not getting the benefits. They're not getting the benefits of the old humanities on the one hand, and on the other hand, they're not getting enough specialized training to get jobs.
And many are coming out of school with huge amounts in student loans. Mark Yudof, you've actually written a few articles, several of which I read this afternoon. One in which you describe many institutions as having been left in a purgatory of insufficient resources and declining competitiveness. Is that really what this is all about?
Well, it's not what it's all about, but it's a part of the picture. I actually agree with much of what Jack has to say. I think the English department and most universities would be surprised if they were viewed as corporate lackeys. I mean, they're really very much against the tide of people going to university solely for instrumental reasons to get a job. And I happen to agree with much of what Jack has to say, but it's not because General Motors has undue influence in the English department. I doubt whether they have a vote.
But you don't think the humanities departments, Mark, are getting stiffed by this increasing attention to more, shall we say, productive parts of the university?
Yes, I do think that's true. And what's happening is, I'll take the University of Texas because I know it well, less than 20% of our funding comes from the state of Texas, and we use that for what I would call the core educational purposes. And then you have, of course, medical schools and so forth, and they have hospitals and they have clinical facilities and so forth. But the lion's share of the budget is coming from clinical fees. It's coming from tuition. And remember, the students are influential in this process because the more competition you have among universities and, frankly, the higher tuition goes, the more you're going to feel that you need to cater to those students, something that, you know, within reason is quite desirable. But it is true, and it's something that I worry about a great deal, that, I mean, where does a liberal arts college go for that research support? They do a lot of research there. And then Jack's just hit on something which is a sort of postmodern theme. There no longer is a center. I mean, you have a sort of balkanized notion of knowledge, and therefore there's a lack of agreement about what people ought to learn. That is a major problem, but they're related problems. There's a problem that the parts of the university that are going to do better are the engineering college and the medical school, and to some extent pharmacy and nursing, and there's perhaps more agreement on what the core knowledge is that need to be taught, but it's not perfect. When you get into particularly the humanities, that agreement's not there, and They're not these external sources that professors can rely upon for additional funding and that sort of bolster the whole enterprise.
I'm Gail Harris. This is On Point. Mark, I know you have to go in a minute, but I want to ask you about the decrease in public funding that public universities are getting. How do you account for that? Why is that happening?
Well, I'm a guy who tries to look for the deeper causes. And when I used to go around the country, every president of a university or chairman of the faculty senate would always say to me something like, if Mary Smith had only been elected governor or Joe Jones was chairman of the appropriations committee, gosh, it would be heaven on earth here at the university. I think what's happening is you have a number of things. You have the demographic trends. You have families are smaller. You have fewer people under the age of 18 in these families. What are the nation's priorities? And maybe justifiably, they're Social Security. They're locking up the bad guys, pharmaceuticals for the elderly who cannot afford it, and health care in general. That has a way of sort of reducing the shine on a higher education as a public good. The second thing is, particularly since the information era in the late 70s, the private returns on higher education are higher than they've ever been. That is, it used to be a well-paid assembly line worker could really do well in the 60s, and there wasn't that much difference between his or her position and an entry-level job in a corporation, white-collar job. Today, the number is around $1 million more that you will earn as a college graduate over a high school graduate, and if you get master's and professional degrees and so forth, it goes to $2, $3, $4 million. What that means is when you're trying to save money, and that's what state governments are trying to do to meet their Medicaid and Medicare and other commitments, they think of it as more of a private good and say, if you have to borrow $50,000 for 4 years to earn $1 million or $2 million more over your life, that's not such a big deal, particularly when you can get 3% Stafford loans and the like. So I think both those forces are sort of reducing the public's perception of higher ed as a public good.
And Jennifer Washburn, you agree with that?
I absolutely agree that there's been a diminishment in the public sort of perception of their role in funding these institutions. I guess my concern is I think that universities are now trying to sell themselves too much as engines of economic growth, and they're not defending the kind of traditional values that perhaps that Jack was alluding to, and not really explaining to the public better what it is that universities are really here to do for us.
And Mark Udoff, you see that as something of a hybrid going forward.
I do. I think Jennifer makes some powerful points, but Jennifer, until you've been down to a legislative committee and you've gone through the questioning and you sing the virtues of Shakespeare and Chaucer and A Critical Mind, and they are asking you questions about your engineering college and so forth, you really haven't had your attention focused, at least in my case, the way it needs to be. To some extent, I think universities have oversold their role in economic development. I would prefer to say that we should turn out people who are creative and can think critically and are deeply enmeshed in history and culture and so forth. And the best tech transfer we do every year is the thousands of graduates that graduate. That's much better than anything that comes out of our laboratory. And that is not an easy sell in the current political environment, but that's the truth.
So bottom line, Mark Udoff, this could be a corrupting influence, but you say is not or doesn't have to be.
Well, until I see more evidence, and I will read Jennifer's book if she'll autograph it for me.
Sure thing.
I have seen the sirens out there, and I have seen some examples I could point to as being what I think are major mistakes by universities, but I really haven't seen this corporate corruption. I think these other forces dealing with education as a public good, this idea that it's only something for a job and there's no intrinsic value on its own, I guess I see them as they're the tsunamis and the corporate influences. They're waves, but so far the waves aren't as big as the tsunamis.
Jennifer Washburn and Jack Beatty, stay with us. We have to take a break. Mark Udoff, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Mark Udoff is Chancellor of the University of Texas System, formerly President of the University of Minnesota. We're talking this hour about the ties that increasingly bind business with academia. Are you concerned about academic freedom on U.S. campuses as research universities increasingly rely on corporate funding? What are the alternatives for universities today? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the close connections between U.S. business and academia and what all that means for higher education. Is the public interest harmed by the increasing link between the two? And if so, what, if anything, should be done about it? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jennifer Washburn is with us this hour, author of the new book, University Inc., and Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly, is with us as well. Right now, let's go to our phone lines to Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Tom's on the line. Hi, Tom. Welcome.
Good evening. Thank you for having me on. I'm an engineer, and I graduated in the 80s, and I work for a Fortune 500 company doing laser metallurgy research in New Jersey. What I see is happening with the corporate entity, which is really like a monarchy, an aristocracy in America today, they're able to live off the serfs and do what they want. And they're really just passing on the cost of their R&D to the public, and they're affecting the bottom line. And I'd just like to have your comments on that, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Jennifer?
Yeah, well, I think that's a great point. There has long been, economists have been raising questions about this that very much support Tom's point. Essentially, the question arises, if the U.S. taxpayers are funding all this research at universities, does it make sense to license that research exclusively to companies that then can prevent other researchers from using that research? Essentially, the question is, are taxpayers being charged twice? Once through the initial research that they fund, and then next through the higher prices that they're going to pay because that research was licensed exclusively. This gets a little bit technical, but I think listeners can understand the point that one of the reasons that the federal government funds basic research at the university is in order to stimulate broad base research that can be available to everyone. It's really the seed corn for all future innovation. And one of my concerns is that universities are not serving the public interest well by restricting access to that research through these exorbitant fees that they're charging on licenses through patent restrictions and such and the like.
Imran joins us now on the line from Ashland, Massachusetts. Hi, Imran.
Hi, how are you? You know, I just wanted to start off and say that, you know, I started my career on the academic licensing side for two world-class institutions before going over to the pharmaceutical industry. And so I've seen both sides of the equation here. And I just wanted to make three points. I mean, there are a lot of things that she's, your guest has raised, but I guess maybe the three I would focus on is that, you know, this notion that, you know, university research gets tied up with patents and you know, things get locked up. I mean, some of it is true, but by the same token, there's also a fair amount of research that, because it's federally funded, the NIH kind of provides guidelines that say that the research has to be made on a non-exclusive basis unless a good argument can be made for tying it up exclusively. And so there's really a real emphasis, at least for federally funded research, to make it available on a non-exclusive basis. The other point I was going to make was that if it wasn't for the university and industrial, interactions, a lot of the innovations that come out of the university would never make it into the marketplace, and many of the drugs or many of the discoveries would reside on the bench and would never make it into the marketplace, which kind of gets me to my third point, which is that, you know, if you're really worried about your tax dollars, I mean, all of this kind of comes out of the Bayh-Dole Act, which was really an effort that was passed to try to charge the economy because a lot of the federally funded research that was patented remained on the shelves. And so Congress decided that the best place to try to get them into the economy was by vesting ownership of those patents to the universities, because they could make a better case for getting that technology into the marketplace. And so I think that, you know, on the one hand, you know, if you look at something like NASA, we complain, why are we paying for the space telescope? You know, what does it get us, what practical application does it bring us? And then on the other hand, with the universities, it's like, well, why are our tax dollars being used for something that's going to bring a practical return? Why aren't we focusing it on more ethereal pursuits?
And Ron, I think we've got it. Thanks so much for the call. And in fact, you describe in your book, Jennifer, the Bayh-Dole Act as a noble cause, but it changed over time, or at least how it was applied changed over time.
Yeah. I'm really glad Ron brought it up. The Bayh-Dole Act is really essential to this conversation. It was a piece of legislation passed in 1980 that allowed universities, essentially it gave universities automatic intellectual property rights to federally funded research. And so it really launched a lot of the commercialization trends that I've been talking about and that I talk about in my book. I think it was a noble piece of legislation. The intent was good. The problem is that universities are now, because they are trying to extract profits from their research, sometimes they're making very poor decisions about when it's best to liberally make their research freely available in the public domain and when it's better to license it exclusively in order to encourage companies to take that research and develop it commercially. And I just have to correct Ron. It's actually not true that the there is no provision in the Bayh-Dole Act that requires universities to pursue non-exclusive licensing first. A whole chapter of my book is devoted to this piece of legislation and how it got passed. And I think that's one of the flaws of the Bayh-Dole Act, in fact, that it leaves the decision-making entirely up to the university. There have been some very embarrassing recent situations, for instance, with stem cells at the University of Wisconsin, where the university licensed some of its most valuable stem cells pretty much exclusively to the Geron Corporation. And only later did the federal government realize, whoops, you know, we funded a lot of this research, and this is really problematic that you've licensed it so exclusively to this one company. It particularly became problematic after the Bush administration scaled back all of its support for stem cell research, and so it became a big public controversy. But universities are often making decisions that are about their own self-interest, about maximizing their own profits more than they are serving the best interest of science or the advancement of new intellectual inquiry.
And Jennifer, I want you to kind of connect the dots for us, if you will, about how this affects the quality of education, because you say that universities have become less and less places that honor teaching, which is presumably why students go in the first place.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this is something that I really hope that writing this book will stir up more controversy. I think it's extraordinary that we are asking students to pay higher tuition prices than just about at any other time in their history. You know, students are having to take on enormous debt. I think the average cumulative debt for a graduating senior now is about $20,000 a year. After 4 years of college is about $20,000. That's not an insignificant amount of debt to take when you're starting out in the world, and I think that parents and students need to ask questions to their universities about what are their priorities. Why is it that they're pouring money into new biotech laboratories with commercial research implications, new fancy tech transfer offices that cost a huge amount of money to operate, when the actual job of teaching is given such short shrift? Increasingly, this teaching is being, as I said, farmed out to these graduate students and adjunct professors who are really only working part-time. They have no job security. They're shuttling around. They're sometimes called freeway flyers now because they shuttle around from one institution to another. And they have no sense of loyalty to any one particular institution. Going back to Jack's point, it becomes really difficult for universities to really take their responsibility to broaden students' intellectual horizons when so much of their teaching faculty is actually such a contingent workforce that has no sense of commitment to the institution.
Well, and also, Jack, if, as Jennifer argues, students aren't getting the education they're paying for, what does that mean for U.S. intellectual capacity and ultimately its competitiveness in the global marketplace?
Well, I'm the father of a recent graduate, and I won't say where he went to school. But on the one hand, he basically did not get a liberal arts education, although he was a liberal arts major because there were no requirements, and naturally he just took the courses that he wanted. I don't criticize him, but that's the way it turned out. There wasn't someone saying take this, take that; it's good for you. But on the other hand, there isn't a thing in the world he can do. At a liberal arts grad is just it's like a beached whale. What are you going to do in the world? And so, in a way, there's a kind of fraud going on here, it seems to me, from these universities. They're not preparing young people to work on the one hand. On the other hand, they're not really giving them much in the way of culture. And that seems to me a real, real shame.
And an expensive shame.
Oh, boy, tell me.
So, Jennifer, what do you see happening next here? Even more corporate funding or perhaps additional state and federal funding somehow? What's your prescription for change?
Yeah, I have a number of thoughts on that. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, I think universities really do have to do some serious soul searching about what their purpose is in our society. I do think that they're increasingly caving into this pressure to sell themselves as engines of economic growth. They're getting enormous pressure, as Mark Udoff alluded to. State legislators and governors really want universities to spin off the next Silicon Valley in their backyards. That's what they're pushing universities to do. So they want them to pump out new startup companies, new commercial research. Universities need to say, hey, wait a minute. You know, this is not our primary duty. Our primary duty is to teach the next generation of thinkers, the next generation of world leaders, of scientists. We need to focus on stimulating broad-based intellectual inquiry. We need to preserve our cultural heritage, and we need to preserve this public domain for knowledge, which is essential to all future innovation. So I think they need to make a better case for what it is that they have done so well for so long. I mean, after World War II, the federal government had enormous faith in universities and in their value. Industry recognized the enormous accomplishments that university scientists make in their own research and how valuable that was to them. I mean, let's not forget that the biotechnology and the computer revolutions were both born out of academic research labs, out of basic research that industry had no interest in funding. Why did they have no interest? Because it didn't seem to have commercial value initially. So I think that that's just a start. I mean, I would talk about conflict of interest rules and also getting all this patenting and licensing out of the university.
Much more to be said here. I wish we had more time. Jennifer Washburn, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jennifer is author of University, Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. Jack Beatty, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you, Gail.
And you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. This is On Point. For families with high school seniors, the next several weeks are among the most stressful of the year. College applications are in, and now is the waiting game. Will they be accepted or rejected? The process of choosing a college and filling out the applications can be overwhelming for students and harrowing for their parents. Connecticut humorist Hank Herman has recently chronicled his misadventures as a father of a high school baseball player trying to choose a college. Here, Hank Herman reads an excerpt from his new book, Accept My Kid, Please. He uses fictitious names for the colleges being discussed.
It's a Saturday in April. My son's baseball coach has given the team the day off, and I point out to my son that Infinity College and Elite, two schools he's thinking about, not true. He's not thinking about anything. They're two schools my wife and I are thinking about for him. are playing a doubleheader in Hartford just an hour away. In a weak moment, he agrees to go with me. Well, not for the whole thing, he rushes to make clear. We'll catch the end of the first game and maybe stay for the beginning of the second. The day is perfect for baseball, and my son seems to be enjoying himself. By this I mean he's not yet been overtly sarcastic to me and even seems to tolerate coexisting in the same bleachers. He's gone so far as to note that the Infinity uniforms are cool and that he likes the intensity of the head coach. I take all this as a resounding yes vote for Infinity, which makes my heart leap. My wife and I think Infinity would be a perfect fit for our son. The students are extremely bright and extremely sports-oriented. The school seems to have just the right mix of academics and fun. Eager to pounce on this positive moment, I suggest, why don't we take a walk around the quad between games? The main quad is just up a small hill not 50 yards from where we're sitting, so I feel that my idea seems like a reasonable one. Why would we do that, he asks, as if I just suggested he slice off his right hand. Assuming he's horrified at the prospect of being seen walking the campus with me, I modify my proposal. Why don't you just go for a walk around the quad by yourself? Why would I do that? He asks again. So it isn't the walking with me part that bothers him. He really doesn't get why a person would do this. Well, since we drove all the way to Hartford, I thought you might as well have a look at the campus, I reason. Who knows when we'll have the chance to get up here again? He just shakes his head as if confirming to himself that I'm a hopeless case and continues to focus all his energy on waiting impatiently for the second game to begin. The more closely we look into things, the more Thespian University emerges as a favorite of mine for my son. I'm impressed with its academic reputation, the smallish size of the student body feels right, and I sense that my son will be happy straying not too far from his hometown. My son seems fairly favorable toward the school, too. Though I'm unable to pin down exactly what he likes about it, his interest appears to have to do with the cool-looking decal he saw in someone's car and a centrally located baseball field that can be seen from virtually anywhere on campus. Whatever his reasons, he consents to a meeting with the coaches and an overnight stay with some ballplayers. When I drop him off for his visit, he's in high spirits. When I pick him up the next day, however, he seems a little less excited. Was it the coaches? No, the coaches were fine, he says. Actually, he was quite impressed by both the baseball program and the football program. The guys he stayed with were nice guys, too. He really liked them. So what was the problem, I ask? Well, there wasn't much going on. What do you mean, I pursue? Well, the guys I stayed with were all working on papers. I bite my lip, but I can't restrain myself. Matt, this is college, I point out, and it was a weekday night. No, he says, as if pitying my ignorance. It was a Thursday night. But Thursday night is a weekday night. He gives me a look, then zings me with the killer point he's been waiting to make about this particular school. Not on some campuses.
Hank Herman is a columnist for the Westport News in Connecticut. His new book is Accept My Kid, Please. I'm Gail Harris. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.